From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. On today's show, summertime ain't so easy for big-budget movie releases like Men in Black International, but is there more going on than just sequel fatigue? Then Irish singer and actress Jessie Buckley goes country and Scottish in her new film, Wild Rose.
I had no relationship to country music at all before I started this, and I thought I was, I don't know, my peripheral was that it was a bit like...
And we'll meet the singer known as the Cuban James Brown. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Game of Thrones. Critics have hailed the final season as TV's greatest show of all time and era-defining, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, filling in for John Horn. By weekend's end, Men in Black International was hardly in the black. Box office returns for the latest installment of the franchise were disappointing, to say the least, as were critic reviews. Earlier today, we reached Bloomberg's Lucas Shaw, who told me MIB International isn't the only big-budget sequel that's got a case of the summertime box office blues.
It is the latest in kind of three or four different sequels that we've seen over the past month that have not done so well. Now, Men in Black International grossed less than $30 million in North America, and about half of what all the previous Men in Black movies had opened to. It did all right internationally, so its worldwide total is north of $100 million. But given the budget on this movie and what it costs to market it, most people would estimate that it's probably got to gross at least $400 million to even break even.
This is just based on first week in a box office, some of the foreign returns. Isn't it a little too premature to call it a box office bomb?
There are a lot of movies that underperform in the U.S. and Canada and then have legs overseas. And so... they end up sort of eking out a lot more than you would have thought. The first Pacific Rim movie is one that comes to mind. I remember it, you know, it was really expensive. It had all these visual effects. It did okay in the U.S., but then in particular did so well in China that it was successful enough that they actually made a sequel to it. So it's possible that that's the case here, but really the best case for this movie is that, like, it ekes out, maybe break even. It's certainly not going to be a successful movie. And look, it's coming out in the middle of summer. So this upcoming weekend, I believe we have Toy Story 4, which we all know is going to be a huge hit. And not long after that, I think you've got both a new Spider-Man movie and eventually in the summer, you've got Lion King. So it's just got a lot of competition, which makes it harder also to sustain that opening.
Well, despite its underperformance at the box office, how is Men in Black International doing critically with both movie critics and with audiences?
Very, very, very poorly. The scores on most review aggregators like Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes are very low. The audience score on that is a bit higher. You know, audiences tend to be less discerning, but still not really high. It's not one of those cases. Sometimes you'll have a movie that gets like a 20 or 30% score in critics, but 90% on audience, Men in Black is not that movie.
Well, we also saw films like Dark Phoenix and The Secret Life of Pets underperform as well. So is this a case of sequel fatigue or just bad movie fatigue?
I think it's the latter. The thing about sequel fatigue is my colleague Anoush Skoui did a good piece this week on some of the recent bombs and what's behind them. And then I went and looked on the internet and I saw it feels like every summer we have some story on franchise fatigue, sequel fatigue. And that's because Hollywood just makes so many dang sequels. So if you're going to, any summer, there are going to be some movies that work and some movies that don't, either because they're bad or because the franchise is just tired, or maybe the marketing was not good, the distribution strategy is bad. Movies fail all the time. And when it's the summer and all Hollywood is doing is releasing sequels and reboots and reimaginings and things, nothing that's original, of course, some of those are not going to work.
Well, speaking of underperforming, you've also been looking at YouTube Kids. It's kind of been bombing with its target audiences. Kids roughly 14 and under. Just a little background first. YouTube Kids was created 4 years ago, back in 2015. Can you first sort of tell us how it's different from the main YouTube site?
They've used technology to limit the videos from regular YouTube that get pulled into kids, they're supposed to be those that are really only, you know, the types of videos that you'd only want your kids to go on. I was just browsing through it last night just to kind of familiarize myself and remember what's on it. And you'll see kind of what's called an unboxing video where kids open up a toy box and talk about what's in it, or animated stuff, Barbie videos, that kind of thing. You don't have the ability to search for anything and everything. In some cases, you can have search, and it is not one of the main kind of points of controversy with the YouTube Kids app is that it is not all kind of handpicked or curated. It still does pull any kind of user-uploaded video based on YouTube's kind of tagging and its algorithm, which then leads to flaws where every once in a while there will be a video that kind of gets through the censors that should not. The real problem that YouTube has, and as you alluded to in your introduction, is that most kids don't use YouTube Kids. So the latest data that we have in our story this week is that YouTube Kids has more than 20 million weekly users. YouTube has 2 billion users. A lot more than 20 million of those are kids, because if you look at some of the most popular channels on YouTube, whether it's this guy Ryan's Toy Review or Cocomelon, which is for nursery rhymes, these are channels with tens of millions of subscribers that on their own have a larger audience than YouTube Kids.
And that's where all that content created by YouTube users and viewers is going. And so the main site is just kind of monopolized it, I guess.
Yeah, if kids between the age of 2 and 7, it's a little easier to control what they do. And if you're an attentive parent who only wants them to use YouTube Kids, you can probably pull that off. But if you have a kid between the age of, say, 8 and 12, that's a kid who's already dreaming of being like their older sister or brother, who doesn't want to be limited to just this kids app that is probably seen as pretty uncool. They want to be on YouTube. And frankly, the YouTube Kids app might not have enough to satisfy them. And so they're going to want to use regular YouTube, and there just aren't enough safeguards on regular YouTube in the same way that there is on a TV network like Nickelodeon or the Disney Channel. The fact is, look, yes, they might go on to watch one thing. They might go on to watch, you know, their favorite prank, which, though being inane, is child-friendly. But that could then lead to a place, because you have this inexhaustible library on videos on YouTube, that is really unsafe for children.
Lucas Shaw, reporter with Bloomberg, where he writes about the business of entertainment and technology. Lucas, as always, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You can read Lucas Shaw's coverage of the entertainment industry at Bloomberg.com. Coming up on The Frame, the Irish actress who plays a Scottish singer trying to make it big in Nashville.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Sharp Objects, based on the best-selling novel by Gillian Flynn. The story focuses on Camille Preaker, a journalist with a history of psychiatric issues who returns to her rural hometown to cover the apparent murders of two preteen girls. The limited series was hailed by critics as exquisite, hauntingly compelling, and a true masterpiece. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Limited Series and all other categories. Visit hbo.com/FYC for more on Sharp Objects.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The new film, Wild Rose, begins with its feisty main character, Rose Lynn, fresh out of prison. She's got broken relationships to mend, 2 kids to feed, and is nursing her own hunger to become a Nashville country music star.
I'm actually trying to get to Nashville, you know?
Oh.
I'm needing to raise a couple of grand so I can get flights and hotel and it wouldn't it be more than 2 or 3, definitely less than 5.
Oh, Rose Lynn, I'm sorry, I can't just give you money. That's what you're suggesting, which I'm sure it wasn't.
No, it was.
And Rosalind isn't just a broke single mom. She also lives an inconvenient 4,000 miles away from Nashville in Glasgow, Scotland. The actress who portrays Rosalind, Jessie Buckley, is actually Irish. And she caught her first big break 11 years ago, appearing on the BBC TV singing competition called I'd Do Anything. Buckley came in a close second.
As long as he...
I mean, I don't know how I slipped through the net because I was crap a lot of the weeks. And I was so like innocent and ignorant to the whole business of it, you know.
So was it that musical theatre was your first love?
Yeah, probably was, yeah. Well, like where I grew up, that was kind of my peripheral thing that I could be involved with. And yeah, I loved it to the point where I remember one night I was in a production of Jesus Christ Superstar and I think my appendix was bursting on stage and I was like, I've got to finish. And then I went home and mom said, you need to go to the hospital. But yeah, I loved being part of it.
What role did you have in Jesus Christ Superstar?
Oh, you know, third spear carrier from the left. Hugely important, probably my best work.
Well, so what attracted you to Nicole Taylor's script for Wild Rose?
Well, I read it first because Tom Harper, who I'd worked with on War and Peace, had got sent the script and we were having a pint and he was like, oh, I'd really love you to read it. I would only want to do it if you did it. So I love Tom and he could have told me to lie down on a train track and I'd be like, yeah, sure, what time's the train and when are we going? But I then met Nicole and when I read the script, it was just... I'd never really read a woman as irreverently fearless and she's like a tornado in lots of ways.
Yeah.
She has come out of prison ready to just take on the world and she's put the blinkers on of everything that might stop her. And so she's trying to run as far away from who she is and where she's from and what her responsibilities are because she believes that's the only way that she can catch her dream. Well, a big eight wheel rolling down the track means a true love of mine coming back. I'm moving on. I'll soon be gone. You were flying too high for my little sky. I'm moving on.
And you play a Scottish woman who's like enthralled with American country music, but you're Irish. Were you aware of any of this music?
No, I had no relationship to country music at all before I started this. And I thought it was, I don't know, my peripheral was that it was a bit like, wabba-dam, you know, kind of hick. But when I found it and found the really good stuff and the lyrics, really, and the stories that exist within these songs, which are kind of three-minute movies, it's completely stolen my heart. And it is quite like Irish music in ways, you know. There's that kind of tradition in Ireland of the storyteller. They call it the Shanachie, which is this guy who's a travelling storyteller who just travels from town to town with a box and goes into different pubs and stands on this box and recites stories about these different characters that he's met on his travels. And even within the music, there's a lot of resemblances with folk Irish music and folk country music and even the tonality. And it's quite simple, but it's very emotionally deep.
I'm talking to Jesse Buckley, who stars in the new film Wild Rose. Did you have any say? Did you have any input over what songs were used for the film from other artists?
When I was first kind of coming to terms with country music and learning it and figuring out what Rosalind's voice was within this genre, I would... And other musicians like Neil McCall and Jack Arnold, who was our music supervisor, we all bottled up to this shed up in North London every 2 weeks. And there are some songs which, I don't know, you're looking, I suppose, within the film, the songs are an extension of the scene. Or sometimes not, but tonally you're looking for something which will tell a story or an emotional beat of what Rosalind wants to say that she can't say in her real life.
Right.
And often it's just energy-wise. You know, some songs we took, like Country Girl, the Primal Scream song, which is at the very beginning of the film, that was something which came kind of later, but it was so right and so... You know, their version is quite punk rock, whereas ours, we kind of arranged it more country in it, but it just had that irreverence and ballsiness, and you couldn't get, like, more, like, a better kind of... feel for the beginning of that film because you immediately have a sense of who this woman is and where that frustration and that drive is coming from within that song. Country girl, take my hand, lead me through this disease land. I am tired, I am weak, I am worn. But it's a thing that's kept growing organically. We did all the music live, and so some the songs would just take on their own shape within the scenes.
Well, Rosalind's quest is to get to Nashville to break into country music, and she, I think, has a very romanticized vision of what the city of Nashville is and what it represents. I know you were not that well acquainted with country music prior to this project, but if someone had asked you when you were prior to this, what do you think of Nashville? What do you think Nashville is, or what it represents? What was your idea of the place?
It is kind of cowboy boots and cowboy hats and dusty bars and some old dude sitting off in a bar having drank too much whiskey, but who's got a great story. You end up spending the whole night with kind of chatting. I don't know, it kind of, in my head, it smelled dusty.
Well, what were Jesse's impressions of Nashville when you got there?
Well, like, we nearly didn't make it to Nashville at first because when we were initially meant to go, our visas got lost. So, you know, and you can't book the Ryman willy-nilly just because your visa gets lost. So we actually didn't think that we were going to make it.
Oh, wow.
And our whole shoot went on hold for like 4 or 5 weeks. So we didn't know if we were going to even get to that part. So when we got there, it was kind of like resembling Rosalind's whole journey in itself. So we got there and it was like this kind of hallowed ground of like, oh my God, we're here.
I was born without a whisper. I was born beneath the rain. And when I reach...
So the character of Rosalind... her employer, who's wealthy, kind of recognizes her talent and helps her get on to this larger stage in front of this audience of people that could support her in her career. And she has a difficult time when she's finally up on that stage. Like, she freezes up. The way you played that scene, did it come from any personal experience at all? Could you draw on anything that's ever happened to you as a performer?
Oh, I've had moments like that. It's never stopped me. Even while I was filming Wild Rose and I was in a really, like, trusting environment, I was getting the most horrendous panic attacks, like, before scenes. And it's always interesting what scenes would initiate those attacks. But it's never... I mean, the thing is you can't. Especially if you're on set, on a you know, you're part of a team and you've got to pull yourself together. And Tom was incredible because actually... Whenever those times would happen, he would take me aside and say, he'd be like, are you okay? But he was also like, this is very honest and this is human, and maybe put it into the scene, see what happens.
Does that also apply to when you're performing as a musician?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It was so funny. The other day we were in Nashville and we were supporting Ashley. We did like a few songs with Ashley McBride. And I was like a black sheep. I was like, oh, hello. I'm like this kind of Englishy, Irishy, like, you know, and they're all like, oh, go on, Ashley, kind of real redneck. And I got up and I was quite nervous because she's so brilliant. And I was singing Guilty. And like when you have this amazing... song called Guilty, and when you have that aliveness with an audience, like, you have to be awake to them. It changes how you sing something every time. And as I was singing, she's got like these quite incredible mullet wearing bulgy women, and they were like, oh, we're going to give you something to feel guilty about, sweetness. And I burst out laughing. I nearly didn't make it through the song. But it was such an exciting moment because they like gave you something and it changes. I mean, my nerves were like, screw you, Jesse, like, this is hilarious. Yeah, yeah. Go with that.
Actress and singer Jesse Buckley stars in the new film Wild Rose in theaters June 21st. Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Frame, the singer who's known as the Cuban James Brown.
Make me an angel that flies.
U.S.-Cuba relations appear to be sliding back to the Cold War era. In April, the Trump administration announced a new policy, reversing changes President Obama put into place 5 years ago. Cubans who want to visit the U.S. now have to travel to a third country to apply for visas. But that didn't prevent a recent visit to L.A. by Sima Funk, the singer who Billboard magazine named one of the top 10 Latin artists to watch in 2019. The Frame contributor Beto Arcos spent some time with the singer, who's called the Cuban James Brown.
It's a Friday night at the no-name restaurant and bar on Fairfax. The place is packed with a couple hundred people as Sima Funk and his seven-piece band deliver a blistering set of dance music. Sima Funk is the brainchild of 30-year-old Eric Iglesias, a self-taught singer who moved to Havana 8 years ago from the province of Pinar del Río. Iglesias did not attend Cuba's renowned music schools, and he doesn't come from a musical family. But he grew up absorbing a wide range of music, especially American pop, which he heard on cassettes in the family car.
Every time that I could, I get into the car and I put a cassette, and I just literally I kill the battery of the car, just listen music like Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson with the album Invisible. That is one of my favorites. It's my favorite actually. Stevie Wonder also.
Iglesias got his first break. He successfully auditioned to sing background vocals for pop singer Raúl Paz. He began collaborating with different bands and projects. Iglesias joined Interactivo, a collective project with some of Cuba's most prominent alternative music figures, led by pianist Roberto Carcassés. During the time he was with Interactivo, Iglesias and a couple friends created a cover band called Los Boys, and he started to develop his own musical ideas.
Because I was crazy with the rhythm, so I say, man, I need to start to experiment how I can know this way to sing, this way to perform the groove. So I say, let's make a band. We only gonna do covers from Stevie and from Michael Jackson. Once we understand what is about this product that they have, then we pass to other stuff.
That was the plan, but instead, Los Boys started making all kinds of other music, like this one called What You Think. Los Boys got a contract to work for 8 months on a cruise ship in the Mediterranean. When the tour ended, Iglesias had saved enough money to buy the equipment he needed to record his first album, but he didn't have a name. He learned about the Cimarron culture, runaway slaves in Cuba who created their own communities and lived freely in the forest.
Black people from many places, from many tribes, from Nigeria, from many places of other countries, and all they was living together, you know, with different sounds, with different groove, with different rituals, with different, maybe different God even. And they all live together, and they have to live together because it was the only way to be... to live without be a slave.
He called on some friends, and together they came up with the name Sima Funk, combining Cimarron and funk. Ya no sé qué hacer contigo. Sima Funk's manager is Argelio Rodriguez. He says the respected pianist Roberto Carcassés gave him some valuable feedback.
We were in a car, leaving a concert, and when he heard the record, he said, "This is going to be a big thing." That's the first time I heard that.
Sima Funk has been touring the U.S. for the past 6 weeks, making stops in 16 cities, including South by Southwest in Austin, New York, Chicago, and New Orleans. But this is not a normal U.S. tour. I recently caught the band having lunch and jamming at San Julian Park in L.A.'s Skid Row, an area with a huge homeless population.
We always try and make everything two-way, so as much as we can bring Cubans and Cuban culture and thought leaders to the U.S., we do. So we bring a lot of entrepreneurs and cultural acts here.
That's Colin Laverty, the man behind Sima Funk's tour. Laverty is a leading expert on U.S.-Cuba relations. He runs Cuba Educational Travel, an organization that takes Americans to Cuba. During the tour, Laverty organized showcases for Google, YouTube, and Netflix. I asked him why he took Sima Funk to Skid Row, and he told me what the band said to him upon arriving.
You know, 2 nights ago, we performed for Leonardo DiCaprio and Sylvester Stallone and a star-studded lineup on a $40 million mansion in Beverly Hills overlooking all of the city. And 2 days later, we're here in Skid Row. And so I think in terms of getting a taste of America and understanding and also, you know, appreciating what they have.
On another night, Sima Funk took part in a Q&A and performance at the Grammy Museum. Moderator Scott Goldman asked Iglesias if he considered himself a renegade, changing the perception of Cuban music. Iglesias was candid.
No. It's not like this. I'm just recycling what is done already. You know, I not changed anything. I'm just doing things. I'm putting music style. I'm putting this way, this stuff. I'm putting together in a personal way.
After the Q&A, Sima Funk performed to an adoring audience that could not stop dancing. Colin Laverty says Sima Funk has the talent and the vision to become the biggest modern-day Cuban artist.
So he is going to be the face of Cuba. He's going to be the cultural ambassador of Cuba, and I think that serves a very important role in terms of allowing Americans to understand the talent, the kindness, and the warmth of the Cuban people, which he clearly represents.
Laverty says, for 60 years, we've been relying on governments to resolve U.S.-Cuba relations, and they haven't done a very good job. But he believes cultural exchange can continue to build bridges, especially with artists like Sima Funk. For The Frame, I'm Beto Arcos.
Sima Funk is slated to perform July 6th as part of the Audacity of Sound Festival in downtown Los Angeles. And that's it for today. I'm Steven Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow. Bye.